Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, coronavirus and the economy. As the U.S. government struggles with the public health crisis, another is emerging. The impact the virus could have on the economy. From the volatile stock market to the plunging price of oil to the impacts on travel and small businesses, there's mounting pressure on the White House to offer a stimulus plan. To learn more about how bad things could get and what kind of financial package might work, I spoke with Vijay Vaitheeswaran. He's the U.S. business editor for The Economist. He joined me Tuesday morning by Skype. Vijay, talk about how this public health crisis morphed into what also appears to be an economic crisis.
You're absolutely right. We have an unfolding pandemic. It hasn't been declared as such, but that's really what we're in the early stages of. But we've seen quite a severe reaction from financial markets, the worst performance really since the global financial crisis a decade ago, though there has been some rebound of late. But I think that's one dimension of it, how financial markets are responding. And there's the bigger question about how the real economy, how jobs and companies and supply chains respond. And in both of those fronts, we have reasons for concern.
When you say reasons for concern, I see that the markets are up somewhat this morning. As you and I are speaking on Tuesday morning, does that indicate something positive? What's going on here?
So there will always be multiple points of view on the marketplace, people looking for buy opportunities. And so I wouldn't read too much into a short bounce back. The bigger picture here is that, we were at already very long in tooth with the U.S. economic expansion and business cycle. That is the biggest expansion in economic history since we started keeping records in the U.S., biggest stock market boom, longest lived since the time of the global financial crisis 10 years ago. And so there were many reasons why stocks were probably overvalued and it was time for a correction. So I think the coronavirus and the related economic concerns, which we can dig into a little bit, are giving people who are investors a reason for pause or even an excuse to look on the downside. I think that's one underlying factor we need to keep in mind. Just tech stocks, to take an example, have gone on a $2 trillion valuation bull run in the last couple of years. Those are just the big names like Apple and Microsoft that people would be familiar with. And even before the recent sell-off, it was pointed out that just the five biggest tech companies, again, sometimes they're called the FANGs, but Facebook, Apple, Google, and so on, were nearly 20% of the valuation of the Standard & Poor index of the big companies, roughly where we were in the year 2000 before the dot-com crash, when the five biggest companies made up about a fifth of the valuation. And so people were looking at parallels even before this last few days of market correction.
I'm sure you saw President Trump's comments yesterday saying he was going to try to help consumers and the entire marketplace by cutting back on, for example, payroll taxes, some sort of stimulus plan. What's your thought on that?
I think that this is necessary. In fact, we need to do more. This is a very unusual kind of crisis, unlike other kinds of shocks to the world economy. For example, the global financial crisis 10 years ago, we had a shock on one side of the system. But here we have both supply and demand crunched at the same time across up to 200 countries eventually. If you look at the way that previous pandemics have spread over time, this is going to affect most of the world in a significant way. And it's very difficult for governments to respond when you have both supply and demand affected. And of course, the supply side has been affected in part because so much of the world's, many of the world's supply chains originate in China. So we had an important shock to that system with factories being down, with workers returning only slowly, many companies with out of stocks, for example, and unable to get production at the levels that they would want. But on the demand side, the virus has made people afraid to go out. In some places like Italy and China, they're actually quarantined. But in many parts of the U.S., for example, people are not going out to restaurants, conferences, and travel is being canceled. So you're seeing much less spending due to voluntary decisions made by consumers. And a lot of that has to do with uncertainty and fear. And it's very hard for example, for the Federal Reserve Bank to deal with people's fear and unwillingness to spend just by cutting interest rates. That doesn't really fix the supply chain or make you less afraid to go out.
So what more should be done?
So there's three things that governments should do now. The first and most urgent task is to get money and manpower to hospitals, the front lines in actually fighting the virus itself. And here, there's some good news. The World Bank has made $12 billion available. The IMF has released about $50 billion to countries around the world. Congress is allocating around $8 billion so far. But let's remember, even though we have a fine healthcare system, we lack ventilators, we lack protective equipment for staff, in part because American hospitals are not paid to be prepared. It's our model of healthcare. And so we probably have inadequate equipment, so we need more money right on the front lines, and that's slowly beginning to happen. The second thing, equally important, is to encourage patients to come forward for testing when outbreaks are still small. This is a little bit complicated in America because we have something like 30 million people without health insurance and others without sick pay, for example. And so if you are going to lose your daily bread and be unable to meet your rent for the month, if you come forward and if you're feeling a little bit sick and try to go to get a test and you're not sure if you can afford the test, it's possible that many people will not come forward. But from a public health perspective, that's terrible. We want anyone who has the relevant symptoms to come forward, to go for testing, to get the medical help they need, and not to worry that they can't afford it. And the Trump administration has said that they will pay for the testing. But we probably need more. We need sick pay and other forms of compensation to make sure that people who are sick come forward quickly so that we can help contain the virus. That's the second point. And the third point is even more broadly than that. This is a case where both left and right must come together to agree that government has to step in to support the economy. Again, because of the nature of the crisis is very different from a financial crash, as we saw with the global financial crisis, which involved complicated derivatives and bad behavior by financial companies and the real estate market. This is a very different kind of external shock. And so we may need direct income support from the government, for example, for individuals for some period of time, and including measures that are already being done in China, for example, that is to help the companies that are going to lose revenues. They still have to pay their taxes. They have wages. They have to pay interest. Banks are going to call in their loans on those companies. And so they may need government support as well. And this is a good case in the public interest to do so temporarily.
Let me ask you about that third point first, because President Trump made it clear he was going to Capitol Hill today to talk to Republicans about financial help for the country, what needs to be done there. It sounds as though he's talking with his own party and not bringing Democrats into it.
I think that this is a kind of national crisis that we are facing that requires bipartisan support. I think this is really a moment for our political leaders to rise above partisan politics, even though it is an election year, because I think the virus doesn't distinguish between Republicans and Democrats. And if the economy tanks dramatically, even to just take the interests of the president and the Republican Party, it is not in the interest of President Trump's reelection for us to face a more serious economic crisis this year. It's the old political saying that Bill Clinton's advisor, James Carville, once pointed out, it's the economy, stupid. Most incumbent presidents who have a strong economy win re-election. That's a powerful determining factor, or at least a coincidental factor. On the other hand, if the economy tanks on the eve of an election, many more people are likely to either stay home that might have voted for you or cross the party line and vote for the other guy. And so I would argue it's in the interest of Republicans to try to find a robust response to this crisis that makes economic sense so that they can actually keep the economy from falling further down a trap.
Now, let me ask you about your second point, encouraging patients to come forward. Many of those who perhaps are showing symptoms fear the loss of pay because many are workers who do not get paid when they don't work. What would your advice be to the president in terms of how to mitigate that problem, which is all across our economy?
You put your finger on an important flaw in our American health system, and that is not only that a number of people are without health insurance, but perhaps a quarter of employees in America have no access to paid sick leave.
Right.
And only scattered cities and states offer sickness benefits. So this is a clear case where the federal government needs to step in and offer direct compensation or sick pay, as it were, but also to encourage companies and compensate them to be more generous for employees that come forward and that do get themselves tested, and to make sure that the costs of that testing are also absorbed. A big reason a lot of people don't go is the out-of-pocket payments, for example, might be quite large, even if you're covered in theory. So people worry about that as well. How much is the out-of-pocket? And so this shows some of the weaknesses of our approach to healthcare. Now, we can have a different debate another time about the merits of Medicare for All or other forms of health systems. But at a minimum, when there's a public health emergency, I think all Americans can agree that we need to contain the public health emergency. And having people come forward early with symptoms is surely in everybody's interest.
Of course, the other aspect of that is just how many tests are currently available and will be available in the near future.
You're right. America has been slow compared to other countries. We can look at, for example, South Korea, which has been much more proactive and has a much higher rate of testing. In the U.S., it depends on what numbers you look at. But you know, for a country of our size, over 300 million people, I've seen reasonable estimates saying that maybe a million tests are available now, perhaps. My own physician in New York, who I saw a couple of days ago, said he hadn't gotten any tests yet, though he's been desperate to get them. He'd hoped to get them this week. And so just to give an idea that we are, in fact, behind the curve. But there is reason to think that we're ramping up quite quickly, including the important inclusion of private sector testing companies. I think that will help spread the availability of tests quickly.
BJ, do you have any theories as to why the U.S., supposedly the most advanced country in the whole world, why has the U.S. been so slow to respond to this virus?
I have a couple of responses to that. One, there is a clear and causal link, and that is we have seen underfunding of pandemic preparedness. The White House Office of Pandemic Preparedness was sidelined and cut under the current administration. And so we have seen a weakening of pandemic preparedness. That's a simple, direct reason. But there's a bigger reason as well that should be more troubling. It's not only the U.S. that has been slow to respond. A number of countries around the world were slow to respond and are only now getting it that this is a significant pandemic in the making. Just to give an example, a country like Indonesia, which has strong ties, trading and cultural ties with China, for a number of weeks claimed that it had zero cases. And that seemed very puzzling to experts. But the reason they had zero cases is because they were doing no testing, including of people that came off the plane with China from China. They didn't test. And one official said, the tests are very expensive. And so when you have a policy of not testing, you're going to get zero people having the virus. But that's a false number. In fact, many people might have the virus. And globally, many more people already have the virus. But we have a pretty good idea that about 80% of people or so have no symptoms, or they show no symptoms. They're asymptomatic. And so that means that they don't look like they have the virus, but they're still potentially spreading the virus to lots of other people. And so this is a more pernicious problem. We have not learned from previous waves of pandemics that have come through, from SARS, from Mexican swine flu, avian flu. We've had regular warnings coming every few years that we need to be more prepared for an age of what are called zoonotic viruses. Every year, two or three potent viruses cross over from the animal kingdom to humans and have the potential to be a lethal global pandemic. And we have heard these warnings for 20 years. I used to be our healthcare editor here at The Economist, and I covered these at that time. And I remember more than a decade ago speaking to the world's leading virologists and epidemiologists, hearing these warnings that we need to do much more in terms of surveillance, that is, watching in places like Southeast Asia, China, and Africa, where often humans and animals live in very close contact, or people might eat bushmeat, or you may have these wet markets, as we know about in Wuhan, where exotic animals are coming in close contact with humans. They need to be monitored. There needs to be more testing. There needs to be changes in behavior, in social norms. And there have been brave scientists who have done this, but they are underfunded. And we have not made this a serious effort as a global society. So to me, that's the deeper point. It's not just an American political problem. We are not ready in our mindset to prepare for pandemics.
And now to your first point about getting money and manpower into hospitals quickly. With these, as you point out, a doctor who is desperate to get the tests into his hands and those of his patients, if the Congress does not come together quickly on this issue, how is that going to affect getting the money and manpower into the hospitals?
First answer is, what a tragedy. If our Congress, the elected body of our democratic representation, cannot come together at a moment like this, where has our democracy come to? If there's any problem that deals with the public good, where we need to have our representatives step up and act decisively, this is that problem. This is not a political problem. And so it would be a tragedy if that happens. However, all is not lost, because we do have decentralized power in this country. States do have some rights. And for example, Governor Cuomo in New York declared a state of emergency a couple of days ago, as have some other authorities around the U.S. That releases additional budgetary funds that allows governors to have more resources to help hospitals to mobilize, you know, funds for this sort of thing. It can't be enough on its own. We do need Congress to act to authorize more funding so that they can be directed to the right agencies and to the right facilities. But I think that it's not all is lost.
Now a quick break. More of my conversation with B.J. Vaitheeswaran when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with B.J. Vaitheeswaran. He is U.S. business editor for The Economist. B.J., we are now hearing the word recession. What are your thoughts?
I don't like to spread panic. In fact, we should all remember the words from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. That's not quite appropriate in this coronavirus era, because we have an actual virus to fear. It's not simply a figment of our imagination. It's fine to be concerned. But if the fear turns to panic, then it will become worse than the virus and the damage it can do. Just to give some perspective, again, I take this both the novel coronavirus and the disease that it causes, which is called COVID-19, quite seriously. It is something of concern. It is going to, unfortunately, lead to a number of deaths. But we have some historical context by looking at other pandemics in the past. And I think this is something that in time will come to be seen as something we can manage. On the worst day of deaths so far for coronavirus, something like 108 people died. On any given day globally, more than 25,000 people die of cancer. Nearly 50,000 people die of cardiovascular diseases. Over 4,000 die of diabetes. Never mind murders or suicides. And of course, the ordinary garden variety influenza kills many thousands a year. So let's keep this in perspective. That's the first point. The reason people are as concerned as they are, of course, is the unknown. We don't know how much worse it can get. But we have a pretty good idea from the science because this virus has been sequenced. We can see how it played out in Wuhan. We see a country like Korea, which has excellent control, and Japan, which has had quite good control, how it evolves. We know, for example, the virus came to London some weeks before it came to New York, and we can see how a multicultural, multi-ethnic, robust global city like London handled it, and that can give New York, for example, or San Francisco, a sense of how bad things will get. And the answer is, it's pretty good. London is not in chaos. It's not the time of the bubonic plague. I just want to set some context here. Having said that, it is possible that this virus and the economic consequences of it will tip us into recession. That is one of the scenarios that economists are looking at. It's not the main scenario or the baseline scenario. What's more likely is that it will shave off a significant amount of the growth that we expected for this year. And we didn't expect that much growth, to be honest. The world economy was a bit anemic. America was expected to grow perhaps 2% this year. That's good, but not great. Europe and Japan were much, much weaker. And so it's definitely going to have a hit on the main global economies. Understandably, China will grow much less than expected. Now, if things go horribly wrong, then yes, it could become a global recession. That's the unlikely case, but it is possible.
There are those who've warned that perhaps this coronavirus will not be so terribly serious this year, will burn itself out, but that next fall or next spring, it could really bounce back and hit us even harder.
So let's unpack that argument a little bit. If the argument is that the emergence of this what's being called a novel coronavirus, because scientists believe it's new, that we haven't seen something like this before in humans, over time will begin to evolve and may come back a season or two later in a different form, the answer is probably yes, that's quite a serious possibility. Now, will it come back in a form that's more lethal to humans or less lethal? Nobody can predict that because no one has a magic eight ball to tell them the future. The Spanish flu, if you go back to history, did in fact first arrive in a weaker form. We now know from evidence that's been captured and analyzed that it did come back in a more lethal form later and became the devastating pandemic that it became. But let me offer some hope. If you say that we have another season or two for it to come back in a potentially stronger form, I would point out that unlike in 1918, we now have multiple teams of geneticists and pharma companies and biotech experts rushing to develop a vaccine and rushing to develop new forms of therapies that we couldn't possibly imagine back during the time of the Spanish flu. So time, in a sense, is on our side. Mm. The problem is really the virus we have today, for which we have no effective remedies other than social distancing, washing our hands, self-reporting, and governments stepping in and companies stepping in to say, work from home, we will pay your sick pay, let's contain it as much as we can. But we have no meaningful scientific tools at the moment, but scientists are rushing to develop those, and I think we will have a decent chance of getting those in that time frame of 1 to 2 years.
Would your thought be to contain this virus by closing down schools?
It's a very difficult decision to make. I think if you were to look at universities, I think the case is a lot clearer. If you look at professional conferences or get-togethers like the South by Southwest, Festival that was recently canceled in Austin, Texas, or the Mobile World Congress, a big get-together in Barcelona. I think those are easier decisions to make because they generally concern grown-ups, adults, and often people in the working world can teleconference, for example, and still get things done.
Sure.
If you shut down all public schools, what do the parents that don't have childcare do? You suddenly have a lot of ripple effects that are going to be quite potent and that have social consequences that are often have disproportionate consequences for those of low income who may not have other resources to take care of those children. But public health must come first, of course. And so if it is determined that the pace of, at which the virus is progressing is faster than hoped, or that our thought on what is the fatality of this virus changes because of new evidence, then, of course, authorities must shut down schools if that's, again, that evidence presents itself. But on the current evidence, it doesn't look like shutting down schools for young children is what most authorities are going to do based on current evidence. On the other hand, the next 2 months, I think, will be severe with many, many cancellations. And my reading of the situation is that many people will self-isolate and a number of school districts may go ahead and shut down. But I would just point out that is not the current advice from the World Health Organization or CDC.
BJ, let's talk about the impact of plunging oil prices here in the U.S.
Of course. Over the last few days, we've seen something extraordinary. That is the OPEC oil cartel led by Saudi Arabia, which had an alliance with Russia, another big oil producer, had a falling out. The Saudis and the Russians had been propping up oil prices over a number of years. And because of this falling out between the two superpowers of oil, the Saudis took the decision to dramatically expand output and cut global prices. We've seen a plunge in prices around $50 down to $30 a barrel. So that's the latest news on this. We're going to see prices stay lower for a while. If this had happened 10 years ago or 20 years ago, this would be good news for the global economy. And the reason is lower oil prices are good for consumers. You know, when the gasoline prices at the pump come down, that helps the ordinary American save a few bucks. Your gasoline bill for the month comes down. Maybe you can take a few more trips. Because you have a few extra dollars in your pocket, you might go to Walmart and buy some more treats for your family or go to the restaurant a couple more times a month. What's different this time? There is still this so-called positive shock to the economy from the lower oil prices, but it's not as big as it would be during normal times, because when you're afraid to go out of the house, to go to Walmart or to go to restaurants because of the coronavirus, having a few extra bucks in your pocket doesn't motivate you to get out of the house. So we may not see the positive impact on demand that we normally would have over the next few months. The second problem is that the U.S. used to be, in effect, the largest consumer and importer of oil from other countries. But since we had the shale revolution over the past 10 years, we are now an enormous producer of oil. So when the oil prices plunge like this, our own shale producers are in deep distress. We saw that the companies that have been hit most on the stock market have been oil companies, and the debt of these companies is now in deep distress. We're going to see a number of bankruptcies if these prices prevail for some period of time. And so the oil patch, states like Texas, Oklahoma, are going to have a much harder time of it on the economic front. And of course, those people that hold their debt, the financial investors, will also have a hard time of it. So those are the two reasons this oil price shock is different from previous shocks.
So while the president tweets that falling oil prices, falling gas prices are good for the consumer, he's not taking into account the larger national global picture.
That's true. Now, it's probably nothing wrong for a cheerleader in chief to emphasize the positive at a moment when people are potentially panicking and cowering in the corner, to have a president say, guess what? The oil prices are really going to hurt American oil companies and oil stocks are going to fall through the floor and your debt that's held by them could also collapse. That might be a strange, if true, statement to come from your president. Now, this is supposed to be a moment of confident leadership as well. But I would add that that should come with competence on the public health front, which we have not seen.
Vijay, we've heard in just the last day or so that China's rate of infection seems to be slowing down and that the Chinese leader has actually gone to visit a hospital. Does that indicate to you China's ability to recover from this? And does that give us here in the U.S. some reason for optimism?
I think guarded optimism would be the right way to think about what's happening in China. There are reasons to think that the Chinese approach to managing this, which has been quite draconian, has produced results. Now, they were very slow to come off the mark. They were not open in their initial communications. Indeed, they were misleading. They even punished some of the doctors who tried to sound the alarm. But afterward, perhaps the pendulum swung to the other extreme with these massive quarantines and aggressive measures. It does appear that the rate of infections is slowing down. If you look at the new cases reported daily, China has now become one of multiple countries, Italy, Iran, and others, now having lots of new cases being reported, of course. And so we have multiple sources of these new cases that will be probably of concern to the world, not only China. Is this good news for the economy? Yes, I think Chinese factories are coming back online. Workers are returning. There is a risk, however, I have to put a footnote on this guarded optimism, that is, we may see reinfections when lots of workers come back to dormitories. And I spent 6 years in China covering business for us at The Economist. I visited numerous Chinese factories, the Foxconn factories that make the iPhones that most Americans are familiar with in Shenzhen. Workers are 8 to a room in their dormitories, just to give you an idea. And these are actually among the nicer facilities at Chinese factories. They're actually not sweatshop conditions, but reasonable conditions compared to other factories. But people are packed in very closely. And some of the people coming back from the villages will carry the virus with them, even if they don't have symptoms. So the fear is that we'll see a wave of reinfection or a spike one more time. So we hope this is not the case, but it is possible.
I know you are particularly concerned about small businesses here in the U.S. Talk about what you feel should happen.
I think this is a potential tragedy for a number of small businesses. If we just take, for example, the case of the South by Southwest Festival, the tech conference that also had sort of a lot of music and barbecue and some of the wonderful things that Austin has to offer. It's the biggest moneymaker for a lot of small businesses like restaurants and other catering companies. They will have no money, because all those people, the thousands of people with the big corporate bank accounts, are not coming to Austin. And while the big hotels may be able to survive, how are the small guys going to, especially the workers, often gig workers that work for them, how are they going to get paid when there's no job? And we don't have a good answer for this in our system in the U.S. And so that's why I argue that we should have direct intervention from the government for the, there's no reason to stand on free market principle here. I think this is an example where, you know, we have argued on the editorial pages of The Economist that this is a moment for government to supply the economy directly by helping affected people and helping companies pay bills and even to borrow money if they need it. For example, banks may call in their loans, because in America, our banks are run in the private sector. The government can't force banks not to call in loans from these small companies. In China, the government owns almost all the banks directly. And so they have simply told the banks, you are not allowed to call in the loans on small businesses, extend them credit. In America, we have to use other methods, again, because of our capitalist system. But among other things, the authorities could fund banks to lend to firms that are suffering, as we did during the global financial crisis. So there are mechanisms, but we need to be innovative and we need to be proactive, something that our government has not yet done so far.
Vijay, any final thoughts for our listeners?
One thought inspired by the 42nd anniversary of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Don't panic. Keep calm and carry on. The world has seen crises. We will survive. And sometimes panic is worse than the actual disease itself. And that, I think that is certainly the case with coronavirus.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure, Diane.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg, and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reams.